I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Jason Blakely, Associate Professor of Political Science at Pepperdine University. We're discussing his 2020 book, We Built Reality, How Social Science Infiltrated Culture, Politics, and Power, from Oxford University Press. Blakely's research is in political philosophy and hermeneutics, as well as the philosophy of the social sciences, and he has published widely. He is the author of Alistair McIntyre, Charles Taylor, and the Demise of Naturalism, and also co-authored Interpretive Social Science. First of all, let me say, Jason Blakely, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm a fan of the show.
Jason, I love the book. I thought it was a great book. Made a persuasive case about the effect of the social sciences on our public culture, mainly for the worse. I was looking for the effect of the social sciences for the better. Maybe I'll make a case for that, for limited case for that later. But thank you for the book. Let me ask, first of all, what was the motivation for you to write the book in the first place?
Well, I did my graduate and doctoral work at UC Berkeley, and Berkeley had a very intense debate in the early 2000s around the human sciences. And this book is in some ways still the fruit of that, of coming to terms with the debate over the human sciences at Berkeley. Specifically identify from within a hermeneutic tradition, but there were a lot of traditions and paradigms involved in the debate. For instance, there was still strong living memory of Michel Foucault having spent time at Berkeley. And you can see Foucault's influence on my book, and that a lot of the way that I treat social scientific theories is not simply as disembodied descriptive theories, but as embodied practices. Also in my tendency to be willing to look at the vulgarization of theory, or not look at theories that are not high theory and how they influence politics. So Foucault's research agenda and style were big at Berkeley at the time that I was there. Many philosophers on campus were engaging in his work. Think of people like Judith Butler and Wendy Brown, who were both formidable presences at Berkeley when I was there. But in addition, there were philosophers coming out of the analytic tradition of linguistic analysis, Oxford ordinary language analysis, that sort of philosophy that's associated with Wittgenstein. My advisor, Mark Beaver, one of my committee members, John Searle, they were thinking intensely about philosophy of action and social ontology. Mark Beaver had written his Logic of the History of Ideas, and Searle had a book on social ontology that had come out when I was there studying. And they were joined by phenomenologists as well. Alvin Noe is there. The legendary Heideggerian philosopher, Hubert Dreyfus, who died recently, very sadly, but he was there, and his students were really impressive. I was friends with lots of his students, and they had a take on the human sciences. And finally, there were a lot of just really impressive interpretive social scientists. Robert Bellah was still alive and working there. He makes an appearance in my book, of course. Paul Rabinow. So there were a lot of people debating what is the political significance of the human sciences. And as a young graduate student, I was just trying to find my bearings in all these debates. And this book still emerges out of that milieu.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, very eclectic kind of influences on you. That's great. I mean, I'm just trying to think through this. Do you find that at any point it's been leads to some cognitive dissonance? I mean, at least I read your book in large part in the hermeneutic tradition. We can get into that more if you want, or, you know, as we proceed. But I get, you know, I mean, the hermeneuticists and the Foucauldians don't always get along very well together, for example. Do you, or, you know, and I can only imagine if you throw John Searle in the mix. So does this lead, I mean, you're thinking to sort of inner conflict about method, or have you sort of carved your own path? Maybe you could say a little bit about that at the outset.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, so I identify with the broader interpretive turn in the human sciences. And an argument I made in my earlier book in 2018, the co-author on that was Mark Beaver, was that the interpretive turn is philosophically pluralistic. So you have a convergence around there is philosophical trouble. I don't mean to erase that. I think you're right. For instance, just to flag one, Foucauldianism is often associated with anti-humanism, whereas Hermeneutics, at least in the Gadamerian vein, tends to avow a kind of humanism. I certainly avow a form of philosophical humanism that comes out of phenomenology. So there are philosophical incompatibilities, but there's also a convergence around certain philosophical principles or doctrines about what it means to explain an action, the philosophical nature of an action, social ontology as textual or interpretive. So there's this broader interpretive turn that in my prior book from 2018 called Interpretive Social Science, we argued that although there's philosophical trouble and you do have to take a stand, you shouldn't erase those philosophical issues, there is room for people like critical realists, linguistic analytic philosophers who made the turn toward meaning holism via Wittgenstein, Foucauldians. So I feel like I'm one of these hermeneuticists who's learned a tremendous amount from Foucault. And do I have some disagreements with him? Yes, that maybe we could get into, but a lot of his form of study and approach I'm quite congenial to, and I think is even sort of massively brilliant, his cultural studies and so on of the emergence of modern institutions and forms of selfhood and whatnot.
Well, that's very, I mean, it's very much in the spirit of Gadamer or Charles Taylor that you would undertake such a fusion of horizons, I guess. So
yes.
So well done. That's good. So let me get into what I take to be the central sort of approach to the book. I mean, like I said at the beginning, the book makes the case that different theories in the social sciences have had a strong effect on our public culture in a few different ways. And we'll get into the specifics in a minute, but, you know, sort of effect on our culture and how we understand ourselves. I'm going to ask you, I mean, maybe you just lay out what you call the double H effect, which I love that term, which is the main way in which these different theories of the social sciences have this effect. So could you say what the double H effect is? And then I can give you my example of my favorite example of the double H effect. Go ahead.
Yes. I want to hear that. I'm interested by that. So roughly the double H effect is this double hermeneutic effect that's well known within the phenomenological tradition, where the basic notion is that you have ontologically in human beings a object of study that can take on or embody meanings. So human beings, their actions are expressive of meanings. They can even be expressive of theories. You think of something like Madisonian institutionalism, where James Madison comes up with a theory of government, interest checking interest, and then people can embody that to a greater or lesser degree. Marxist social theory is also a clear example where world making happens through embodiment. So the double H effect is where a theory that is descriptive or interpretive of the world actually enters into the world through this self-interpreting capacity and changes the world substantively. So this is the stance that comes out of hermeneutics that says that the human sciences are partly demarcated ontologically by the fact that you have an object of study that can take on descriptions of it and be substantively changed by that. Unlike, the claim goes, unlike objects in the natural sciences.
I mean, that hopefully gets into my next question. Although, so let me just say my favorite example, and then you can tell me if this is a good example, or maybe you can tell me your favorite example, which is this example. I don't think you talk about it in your book, but there was this study of economists, professional economists, and I have to say before I start this that, you know, some of my closest friends are economists, so that's my, but economists. Professional economists, it turns out that, you know, there was a study done about who, you know, which out of all the different faculty members in the different disciplines, which did the most amount of service for the university. And it turns out that, you know, according to the study anyway, economists did perform the least amount of service for the university out of all the different disciplines in the university. I thought that was amusing because it's, you know, at least the double H effect is here had an effect on the economists themselves. That is the understanding of the sort of homo economicus, which you lay out in your book, presupposes the sort of activity based on one's own self-interest and not for a kind of civic virtue or for the common good. And so, of course, then the economists would themselves internalize this theory in their own behavior. I don't know what you think about that example, if you have any amusing ones too.
It's a great example. And in a lot of ways, the book is an extended, suppressed philosophical argument that there is something distinctive about the study of the social sciences. In part, one route into that claim is through these double age effects. And the book has this other part that is a cultural map of our present time through double hermeneutic effects. So the first two chapters are on Homo economicus, a notion of selfhood as preference maximizing that has been vulgarized in a lot of ways. It's gotten outside of the hands of professional economists who often make, particularly neoclassical economists, who often make a lot more caveats about, you know, the limits of that model. And through phenomenon like Freakonomics and sort of low popularized forms of social science enter into human self-understandings. And so they're just legion examples of these double H effects in the book. The book is like a tour of how double H effects helped create our own time and our own moment. And yeah, I think that Homo economicus is a big one, that a form of citizenship, right? A certain model of citizenship that was said to be descriptive. I think one I talk about in the book is David Mayhew and his use of rational choice theory and what I identify as Homo economicus to argue that legislators have as their uppermost preference the retention of their office or to be elected into office. And so careerism is sort of the uppermost preference that they're trying to maximize or secure. And I suggest in the book that this actually usurps, that you can do a genealogy and see that there are earlier Republican, small r, Republican notions of representation and leadership in which to have careerism as your uppermost goal or preference would have just basically barred you from being, you know, someone who should be given office. If you think of someone like George Washington's refusal to run for a third term, and by the way, I don't mean by any of this to put some kind of halo around the 1776 generation of liberalism. The point is genealogical. The double H effect there, one that leaps to mind since you asked for one, is one in which a careerist market notion of selfhood replaces earlier Republican conceptions of citizenship, leadership, representation.
That's great. And I wanted to, you know, again, it's sort of more throat clearing before we get started into some of your great examples here. I mean, just by way of introduction, just to get clear on kind of the scope of what you're arguing here and the target of it. It's not just to be sort of blunt about it. You're not in the book, you're not anti-science. You're not anti social science as it's correct. Done in the academy, mm-hmm. right? That you see indeed benefits of science all around us. And I'm assuming that you do say this, that you respect the work of our colleagues in the social sciences. So maybe you could just say, so what is the target in the scope of the book?
The target in the scope of the book at the deepest level is philosophical naturalism, or the idea that the social sciences generate a form of knowledge that is akin to the natural sciences and thereby grant a kind of authority similar to that. So the real target of the book is technocracy, or the notion that that social science gives you status or authority to override deliberative democratic efforts at policy formation, lawmaking, etc. So these kind of an anti-democratic technocracy is the real target of the book. I think that social scientists are often aware of the limits of their methods, their models. They're often generating tremendously valuable information that I've learned a huge amount about our political world from them. And in fact, I say in the book that the book couldn't have been written without the countless social scientists. I often draw on social scientific research that I did not do in order to substantiate or fill out a claim that I'm making. But I think that at the center of the book is an effort to turn the tables on philosophical naturalism, or this view that social scientific theories are analogous to natural scientific theories. And one way to turn them around is this notion that social scientific theories are merely descriptive, that you look through them as though through a looking glass, and the word-object relationship is sort of separate. The book rejects that idea, and instead it begins immediately from the hermeneutic assumption that what happens if I read social science theories as forms of meaning making that are already within the stream of history and culture. And if I do that, then part of what's interesting about social science theories is their vulgarization effects. The way that a social scientist may be very aware of some of the limits of their theory or their methodology or their model, but then they're taken up in the popular arena as claims to a definitive policy that's said to be scientific or course of action that's said to be authorized by science. I think I talk about things like the war on terror as in some ways justified by a vulgarized social scientific discourse. Certainly markets and sort of the rolling back of the state I discuss as a form of the market polis, policing, racialized policing. So there are a whole bunch of places where I try to argue that social science has kind of escaped the hands of its creators and exists as meanings in the world. Is it being abused? Is it being taken out of the hands of its original creators oftentimes? Yes, oftentimes. Sometimes its creators are actively involved in the abuse of its authority. I think of someone like James Q. Wilson or Milton Friedman, but it's going to vary case by case.
Is the problem the our sort of public culture's worship of science, a sort of blind deference to scientific findings as they're presented, or is it the effacement of the distinction between the Geisteswissenschaften and the Naturwissenschaften?
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to, as a hermeneuticist, I come out of those German traditions and debates that I see those as very important to.
It's both.
Is really complicated because in some sense you could read the book as a sort of vindication of populist irate experts and whatnot, but that's actually not, my position is actually quite complicated here. My position is that the overextension of scientific authority dialectically leads to an overreaction and rejection of scientific authority rightly practiced. In other words, ordinary people are told something like, this is an example I go into great depth in the book, but that certain companies and banks are too big to fail. And so after decades of a dominant economic discourse that said we needed to pull back on the social welfare state, on bailing out ordinary people if they had financial problems and whatnot, we have the biggest financial cataclysm of a generation up to that point. And suddenly the argument that's made is, well, these banks and these investment firms are just too big to fail. And why should we believe that? Well, because there's a science of economics that tells us that if these things go out, then the rest of the economy is going to suffer and go out. I think a lot of ordinary people that became involved in things like the Occupy Wall Street movement, but also in a more complicated way, by the way, things like the Tea Party, sensed that this was a bogus overreach by elites to say this is a scientific finding that we have on our hands. And so then I think that feeds into, it's not the only stream, but it feeds into deeper, longer standing traditions in American life that are deeply anti-scientific that I don't have sympathy for whatsoever. Things like anti-vaxxing and strange biblical literalist theories about humans and dinosaurs were walking around at the same time on Earth. I think there's a complex dialectical relationship between the overextension of scientific authority and the over rejection of scientific authority, and that there's a kind of mutually self-sustaining dynamic between those opponents.
Right. And if we recognize the distinction between the social and the natural sciences, that might help avoid that dialectic, right? Because I take it part of the problem is that if you treat human beings as if they're natural objects, then that lends itself to a kind of technocracy, right? Because the beings that you're studying can't respond, right? They're objects, they're not subjects. And people get pissed off when they're treated like objects and not like subjects.
Is that
the idea? I mean, so sort of more hermeneutic approach to the social sciences can actually be, you know, lend itself to the right kind of approach to science among the democratic public.
Right. And something that I discuss in the book is that hermeneuticists hold that storytelling is the central explanatory form in the human sciences. ultimately it's about narrative. Yes, you can use mass survey research. You can use modeling. That one's a little more complicated to talk about it, but you can use statistical research. But ultimately, when it comes to explaining the actions of a self-interpreting, doubly hermeneutic creature like human beings, stories are what capture our form of agency and action. And storytelling became very suspect with the natural science revolution culturally. At least in some quarters, it became very suspect because it's thought to be pre-scientific, right? It's thought to harken, well, it does harken back to our earliest epochs as humans. We have told stories since as long as the record goes back. And likewise, if you just look at the development of individual humans, I have a toddler, you know, he gets stories. You know, if I tell him, here's the scientific theory of the sun, he doesn't get that. If I tell him a story about the sun, you know, and anthropomorphize the sun, he sort of understands, you know, the sun's tired, the sun needs to go. And so I think stories have lost credibility in some quarters due to the influence of naturalism. But stories are also, and here's the evaluative component, if you like, here's the element that has a normative bent to it. Stories are, I believe, more democratic. There's more people can weigh in on them. And so we need to be a little bit clearer about our scientific knowledge can help corroborate, it can do damage to our stories, it can help establish our stories, but it can never entirely displace or replace our stories because our stories exceed any given set of facts at the moment because we can embody them toward a goal. You know, we can try to embody a story. We can try to make an effort collectively or individually towards some goal or aim. And so I think that we need to be much more respectful of ordinary people and we need to listen to their stories. We need to listen to what's bothering them. It doesn't mean we just take it at face value, but we have to have taken the time. We can't just put them on mute and say, I've got a scientific theory of you. You know, it's about demographics, your economy, and now I'm not listening to you. And we also need to be more open that when we deliberate about stories, that's something that's just open to ordinary people. There is no final expert on what stories we ought to live. And that there's a kind of epistemic humility there that hermeneutics advocates for.
Yeah, that sounds all extremely plausible to me. I just sort of return to this at the end, because I do want to sort of come back to see, you know, your suggestions of where we go from here. So that's a good step in that direction. So just to lay out the, you know, the overall structure of the book, you know, it's roughly, you know, it has three parts. In the first part, you talk about the effect of economics and its view of Homo economicus on public culture. Second part, you talk about the behavioral social sciences, which conceives of us as roughly machines, the homo machina, and then social and political sciences on law and order to establish a racial hierarchy in the third part. And I thought we could just, you know, talk through each one. The first one on economics and notion of homo economicus, we've already sort of touched on this, especially, you know, in the neoclassical view of economics and the way that developed in the 20th century. Maybe you could just say a little bit about the double H effects in terms of how the view of Homo economicus, this is probably maybe going to be most familiar to people listening to this, but how the understanding of Homo economicus had a certain effect on American public culture and what the bad consequences of that were in your view.
Sure. So there's a short, I don't call it this in the book, but there's what I think of as a short genealogy of building economic man, of building Homo economicus, that starts from John Locke, that generation of liberals. And one of the, I briefly reread John Locke as not so much, you know, discovering a primitive or natural state of proto-capitalists, but as instead imagining a future society that's never existed or that started to emerge, in which primarily Aboriginal humans are trucking and bartering things like bushels of apples and acorns and plums. He's got all kinds of sort of folksy examples of bartering that are going on in this society, in which individuals are largely self-reliant and the principal social activity is truck and barter. that is the beginning point of the brief genealogical sketch I offer of Homo economicus. But I, like all genealogies, I also want a rupture point. I want where does something change in this story, even if it's a story of origins. And I think there's a big rupture because people like John Locke, people like Adam Smith, these liberals, although they did start to conceptualize of society as a market, they never thought that interests alone could sustain society. And so one of the things I find most fascinating in Locke's Second Treatise of Government, I think it was pointed out to me actually in a seminar with Wendy Brown, I want to say it was the first time I noticed this, is that, you know, Locke offers a universal right to make a living. He, you know, you're not allowed to take more than your share from the commons. And your share is defined at vis-a-vis what can spoil, the spoilage proviso. I think it's in book five or something of the Second Treatise, but also vis-a-vis can other people live, you know? So arguably there's a right to make a living in Locke's treatise. Similarly, in Adam Smith, you've got fellow feeling, right? You've got the whole notion that a society without fellow feeling will collapse. The part of Adam Smith that the people who seem to claim his heritage most vocally don't really talk about, they subsume. You need feelings of solidarity to keep a society together. The rupture comes, I argue, with the emergence in the 20th century of rational choice methodology, where you have this kind of axiomatized, ideally rational agent. Completeness and transitivity are the most well-known axioms of rational choice, that you can rank all your preferences and that you calculatively haggle over them. And so what you get is the beginning of a picture of human beings with the interests and with no social sentiments. That's what they dump and get rid of that's in Locke and Smith, which is the sentiments of social solidarity. People like Milton Friedman, like Gary Becker, presumably think that those aren't very scientific. You know, the social sentiments, the cultural elements of solidarity aren't very scientific. And when it comes to sort of hard nails decision science, you need a framework for understanding human beings where you see them as sort of relentlessly maximizing their preferences. And if, by the way, if they happen to do solidaristic acts, that just fits within the scheme of preference maximizing, which, you know, this kind of is a well-known element of how rational choice colonizes other forms of selfhood. So that form of selfhood, I think, entered into... If you talk to most of my neoclassical economics friends, I do have friends that are neoclassical, they'll tell you, you know what, this is just a model. You know, it's a model, it's got big limits, blah, 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 blah. But what, part of what I argue in the book is that we spent decades with this being a form of selfhood. It entered into our practices. I discussed the Freakonomics phenomenon, but I also discussed things like the construction of an object, the economy, and how people calculate and reason about that. And so what you have is a new kind of selfhood that is an ethical option, I think, that I think of people like Friedrich Hayek, rather controversially, Ayn Rand, maybe less controversially, as poeticizers of the market, of Homo economicus. To me, they're not failed scientists. They're not riding on the shoulders of a sort of science of man. Instead, what they're doing is they're kind of poetic geniuses that inspire people into imagining themselves as rugged industrialists or as people just reading the machines and levers of the pricing system or whatever it may be, and being rationalist and detached in their life in a way that fights off totalitarianism and collectivism and things like this. So I think that essentially, to put it more briefly, there was a second founding, or at least a second founding, to the American state where a new kind of later liberalism, maybe there have been many foundings to the American state, took over, re-narrated the past through this Homo economicus of just the relentless interests, whereas earlier liberals of the 1776 generation, which, by the way, is why they were so hostile to business people being in politics, which is hard for people to comprehend today, that people like Madison and Washington didn't think business people made good politicians. They thought some kind of oligarchic agrarian class of liberals did, which I'm not saying I particularly have sympathy for, but genealogically, there's a major rupture there. And so the market polis is this new kind of American state that's founded around vulgarized forms of rational choice theory that inform a kind of homo economicus minus the sentiments.
That's really good. That's helpful. One of the things I wondered here, and I think I wondered about it in all your different examples, but I'll just say it here, which is, I wonder to what degree it is, well, in your view or in reality, the case that these theories are the ones that are the independent variable, as it were, or whether, you know, I mean, because I could think of a different story, more like a Hegelian on some good days, right? And Hegel says the Isle of Minerva only flies at dusk. So why isn't it the case that it's that the institutions develop in certain ways, and then it's the theories that sort of emerge out of the development of the institutions as a crystallization of what the institutions have been doing for a while, right? In other words, you know, I can see the case, you know, it's the case that the modern post-World War II American economy developed in all sorts of unbelievable ways that expanded human wealth in all sorts of ways. And that was in part because it was sort of unleashing of the market in certain ways. And, you know, to what degree was that the effect of eggheads in universities doing it? And to what effect were those eggheads just sort of responding to phenomena that was already going on?
Right. So I think a lot of popularized neoclassical economic theory is post hoc. Sort of as you're saying, it's theorization. I would kind of put a negative spin on it and say it's a kind of apologetics for an existing modus vivendi, where, you know, certain unfortunate outcomes of the market are re-narrated through new models as always pointing back to some interfering or pollutant element like government intervention or something. So I do think there's a whole post hoc apologetics for the market polis, what I call the market polis, that is very much after the fact. But I think historically, it's important to see that at least some of these theorists were important to and preceded at least the mass popularization and enactment of these forms. So an example in the book would be Milton Friedman's 1955 essay, or sometime in the 1950s essay on the role of government in education, where he argued for the voucherization of charter schools and school choice, kind of quasi-privatization of America's school systems. People like Nancy McLean have given a really interesting backstory here having to do with desegregation of the schools and the way that libertarian or neoliberal economists, neoclassical economists like Milton Friedman were using sort of colorblind language, but in a way it was a pushback against desegregation. But I guess what interests me for the point that you're making is that Friedman stated in a kind of programmatic way that he thought that students should be treated as shoppers and, you know, schools as entrepreneurs, and that if you quasi-marketized the public school system in this way, he predicted that parents would have wider ranges of choices and there would be greater equalizing sort of opportunities. And I argue in the chapter that something like the exact opposite happened of what Friedman predicted. There was in fact a funneling of funds up the economic ladder and whatnot. But to your point, I do think that certain economic theorists were crucial to bringing to articulacy things that might have been in the life world, but were not a mass scale dominant phenomenon at that time. So Friedman vis-a-vis the voucherized school movement, the quasi-privatization of schools, which of course Betsy DeVos is the most vocal and advocate of, the education secretary for the Trump administration right now. So I think that some of these theorists were very much there at an important moment. I'm a bit of an Aristotelian Hegelian myself, so I'm fine with the fact that theorists often actually follow practice, but that doesn't mean there isn't a dialectical relationship between theorization and practice.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, the benefit of a hermeneutical approach is that everything's really an independent variable and a dependent variable at the same time. So you don't actually have to make a case for one being causally prior to the other, that they're sort of interacting. Yeah, I mean, good. I mean, maybe you could say a little bit more about the political science side of things, especially the way that there are many famous books in political science that sort of take on the economic theory. You mentioned David Mayhew, but Bruce Bueno de Mesquita also has sort of taken this on. You know, to conceive of political actors in self-interested terms. I mean, I suppose, again, maybe you could say a little bit more, but I guess I find it hard to be convinced that someone like David Mayhew had a widespread effect on public culture. I mean, I'd like to think that it did, but it seems that, you know, politicians just are self-interested in a liberal regime, right? So I guess it's the same point I've just been making, that it's a regime effect that people like Mayhew and Mesquita are, you know, identifying but not creating. But maybe that's a wrong way to think about it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's related to the question you just asked in some ways. And I think that I wouldn't want to say that citizenship in a liberal public just is self-interested. I don't think that's true. I don't know how you narrate Martin Luther King. I don't find any plausible narration of, say, Martin Luther King. Now, he's not a representative, so he doesn't fit exactly the case you're saying, but he is a citizen within a liberal democracy that is making choices and decisions about our political life. I'm not one to build up the cult of the founders, as I like to call it, but just for genealogical purposes, George Washington's reluctance to run for president for a third term is pretty hard to cram into the sort of Mayhew categories, in my view. And I guess I would also take issue with Mayhew might be more one of my post hoc apologists, but there's still looping effects because, for instance, when I was at Berkeley, a lot of the graduate TAing that was available was to do the American politics classes, which were huge lecture halls, you know, where hundreds of UC Berkeley undergrads would learn about American institutions, and Mayhew was dominant in the characterization, supposedly descriptive, of what representatives are. If you already have self-interested careerist representatives, which you may very well already have, but then you're part of a cohort of students that learns over and over again that political science tells you that that's sort of inescapable, I think that's part of the way we arrive at a kind of false realism. Hence the title of the book, We Built Reality, where the descriptive claims are reinforcing, they're serving an ideological function of justifying and reinforcing bad behavior. I do think it's possible to be a representative who sacrifices civically for some notion of the commons. It's Rousseau's famous from, inferring from the actual to the possible seems like pretty good logic to me. I can think of actual cases of people in our society who have sacrificed for the commons. And so I know it's possible because it's been actual. And the problem with the Mayhewian paradigm, in my view, is that it basically introduces meanings into our political life under the guise of sort of descriptive science. Now, is Mayhew going to say that he's got a global, universal, fully covering set of theories? Maybe not, but that's why these vulgarization effects are important to me. I think it's often taken that way, in the way that you stated it more, that, well, our representatives just are self-interested. And to me, that's how you end up with the place we're in now, which is all politics is worldwide cheating. And so just gather around the biggest cheater who knows how to make a deal better than anyone else, because everyone's just deal-making. And so there is a looping effect where I think there's a reinforcement of a particular kind of democratic culture, small d here, democratic culture, that is supplanting, replacing in rivalry with various forms of virtue liberalism, social democracy, civic republicanism, et cetera.
Yeah, I think this is all good. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, what you're saying is an important addition to what I've sort of long thought about, you know, late 20th century American political life, which is that it has the institutions, the common institutions that we shared, long shared together, have sort of begun to come apart, and there's an increased tendency towards atomization and alienation and mistrust of common institutions, development of polarization and the like among political agents, which lends itself towards embracing, I think, when you have like disembodied, atomized individuals, it lends itself towards embracing a theory that precisely puts a primacy disembodied, self-interested individuals, right? So in other words, like, it seems to me what you were saying about, you know, scientific theories, you know, fits well with the sort of on the ground institutional decay of American political institutions. Does that sound right to you?
That is part of what I'm trying to suggest, is that what we received under the guise of a lot of social theories was actually a new theory of democracy, a highly managerialized one, a highly economized one. I mean, one, maybe James Madison is just, you know, a sentimentalist, but he says, I quote in one of his convention speeches, that famous quote about, if there's no virtue among the citizenry, then no amount of theoretical checks is going to help you. This is from the person who we just read as telling us in Federalist 10 and the other Federalist papers that, you know, interest can check interest, faction can check faction. But here he is saying, by the way, if you think that's the only thing that's going to keep society together, you're in trouble. So something happened with our self-understandings. And part of the philosophical argument that the book is persistently making, the hermeneutic argument, is even if you think, look, Mayhew did a great service to political science, his theories are brilliant, they shed light, blah, 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 let's not neglect the meaning-making features here that can go awry in a kind of Frankenstein-like way. That's part of the message of the book, is yes, but there are these meaning-making, if you want to see them as just straight abuses of the theory, they do exist. People can take them on board phenomenologically. I can go from being someone who narrates my citizenry in one way to narrating it another way, and that matters.
Let's talk about the homo machina, because this is a great section of the book where I think what you're talking about here is the, you know, behavioral social sciences, especially those who seek to apply the hard sciences to the social sciences, like biology and computer science, and so conceive of human beings as machines, but, you know, portray us as machines. You could say a little bit about what, you know, where you see this in maybe popular culture to begin. I'm trying to remember that Pixar movie now from a couple of years ago, which I saw with my daughter, which portrays a young girl, like this sort of inside the inside of her head. I'm not sure. Gosh, I'm blanking on the name of it. Do you remember which?
I haven't seen it. My son's not reaching the age of Pixar yet, so I'll get there. But
yeah, well, yeah, you will. Yeah. So it's from the perspective of a teenage girl, and it's sort of inside her head, and her various emotions are at war with one another. It's a very clever, interesting movie. But the interesting thing about it is it portrays her inner life as a machine. It's a computer, essentially, and the various emotions are sort of running the computer. And you know, it struck me reading your chapter about the way that movie portrays human beings as machines at bottom. It could have portrayed her inner life in a different sort of way, but it chose a machine metaphor, which is interesting.
Yeah, and I think that sort of popular phenomenon is quite telling. I think I open the chapter on homo machina with a reference to the popular show Westworld. And then there was the movie Ex Machina, where part of what I point out there is something interesting happened in the aesthetics of artificial intelligence, just in the cinematic imagination, which is that there was a generation of AI on screen where they were obvious androids, things like Star Wars, C-3PO and whatnot. Whereas in Westworld, you can't tell. The androids are constantly faking you out. Same with Ex Machina. And so the Turing test of, you know, can an AI trick you in conversation was being played out cinematically. And in fact, the androids were human actors. They weren't obvious androids anymore. What I think is going on there is a playing out an expression of a kind of selfhood in which we view ourselves as as a kind of technology or machine that is subject to sort of managerial tinkering or sort of self-help tinkering. But I think that a lot of times the dystopia around movies like Ex Machina and shows like Westworld is that we're afraid of this form of selfhood. We're afraid of a self that acts as if it were a machine, detached, manipulative, unfeeling, unempathetic. The humanistic stuff drops out, the meanings, et cetera, et cetera. And so I see these shows as oftentimes a kind of repressed fear of a highly technocratic machinist society. People like Elon Musk, I discuss in the book, they're afraid of some leap forward in which our computers supersede us in evolution. And for reasons I discuss, I think that's just a completely bogus fear. But I think the real fear underlying it is, no, in 2020, we're all becoming more machine-like. The real fear is of all of us becoming more like our computer vis-a-vis each other. It's a metaphor, in other words, that we're like computers. It's not so much a descriptive theory, it's a hermeneutics. I'm again turning the tables on these theories that say, for instance, computational theory of mind, which I talk about at length, say, well, human beings are like a computer. Instead, I assume this is an elaborate metaphor for selfhood. Now, what light does it shed on our social and political life that so many people imagine themselves as computing machines?
Yeah, it strikes me one of the anxieties that stand behind this is, I mean, as you say, that we can be indistinguishable from machines, but also that machines might be better at being us than we are. I mean, it seems clearly the message of Westworld and maybe even Blade Runner, which you talk about in the chapter as well, that you know, the conceiving of human beings in this way, how we have created ourselves into a mechanized world and have sort of undermined what it is that gives us wholeness and purpose, and yet we can create these things that outdo us in certain ways that we could be replaced by, is kind of an interesting development. And there are sort of those post-humanist figures who at least imagine something, you know, that there's something to be actually welcomed by this, because then we can overcome our sort of embodied machine flaws, right, to do it better.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that this picks up the whole thing from, if you're a hermeneuticist like me, what's distinctive about human intelligence is its significance factor, its semantic factor, is something, again, I discuss in the chapter. But I actually think Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner, is a brilliant movie. Of course, I live in Los Angeles, so to see dystopian images of Los Angeles blasted back at me, it's part of the local culture here. But Blade Runner has this suggestion that I pick up upon and kind of offer as a new Turing test. The way we'll know we have artificial intelligence is not that we can be tricked in a blind conversation with a machine into thinking that we're talking with a human. Instead, I'm not saying, hermeneuticists are not saying artificial intelligence is impossible. They're just saying that symbol processing and syntactical manipulation doesn't get you to human intelligence. Charles Taylor says the computer isn't really doing anything from the strict perspective of philosophy of action, except relative to the goals and significance of some agent that's using it, which is, by the way, really clear when you think of something like a hammer. But with computers, we really overawe ourselves with our imagination. With computers, we poeticize into saying it's computing faster than I am. It's computing vis-a-vis me. I'm here to decipher its numbers. I'm here to put in a set of social practices that have to do with computation. But just out in outer space, the computer isn't, you know, its fan is whirring. I mean, a lot of apps are effective at manipulating and subverting the original intention of the algorithm. Like, you think of the flashlight that turns on your flash for your camera, right? I mean, is the camera flashing or is it a flashlight? Is it a signal that says we're ready to rob this bank, or is it, you know, a way to blind someone who's playing tag with me? What the machine is doing is relative to me. So I think a lot of these anxieties are misplaced. And what's missing is that what's distinctive to human agency, anthropology, is the embodiment of meanings, this thing we've been talking about all along, the double H effects. And so it's not that we'll never have artificial intelligence, it's that if you're going to get at artificial intelligence, you're going to need a new kind of Turing test, one that tests for, as in the opening of Blade Runner, empathy, meaning, significance factor. Because otherwise the computer sort of dumbly does its thing. Now, does it symbol, it's long ago symbol processed much faster than any human being can. Like a handheld calculator can do that, with the caveat that it's only doing it relative to me. But if it were just about speed of symbol processing, then they would have superseded us a long time ago. They, I'm using the poetic language of the machinist self. What's interesting to me is, what does this say about how we treat each other, about our society, about our cultures of solidarity and democracy, that we imagine Decker in Blade Runner going around basically putting would-be machines out of commission? He murders them just because it's his job to do so without any feeling. And the drama of the movie comes from the fact that he falls in love with one of the robots. But think for robots here, other humans that I've turned into machines. And then the movie gets really interesting, in my view, from a hermeneutic perspective.
You know, the double H effect, as you develop it in these two chapters that make up this part, is quite interesting, because you know, if human beings are at bottom essentially complex algorithms, then we can establish our institutions and public life that employ algorithms in order to manipulate human beings to get the most efficient outcomes, right? That we can create bigger machines that are our institutions and practices to gear in the littler machines, which are us, in order to have good effect. So some of the examples you use are great, like the, you know, the romance apps and online dating and the way in which that you use an algorithm to find our closest mates, right? Or the use of, you know, managerial science in order to develop algorithms to make corporations more efficient. You know, the way in which this is, I mean, there's a longstanding modern tradition, of course, in, you know, critiquing the way in which this sort of mechanizes human life. I wanted to ask you, I mean, feel free to talk about either of those if you want, but I wanted to ask you in particular about the political side of things. You talk about the, you know, the development in political science, especially, although this is also in moral psychology, and Jonathan Haidt, you know, has a, you know, a certain view of the sort of biological foundations of political opinion, and that there's, or genetic underpinnings to being conservative or liberal. People like Hibbing, Alford, have developed certain views about that human beings could sort of come to our opinions via some kind of genetic, or influence in our opinions via some kind of genetic inheritance. So feel free to say about what you think about that research, how it has a certain effect on our life, or more generally, how this view of homo machina has a deleterious effect on us.
Yeah. So, and this might be one of these post hoc looping effects that reinforces existing and not sort of an origins genealogy tale that I'm telling in this case. Yeah. So there's this whole paradigm that many listeners are probably familiar with, but for those who aren't, called genopolitics, where the argument is something like the polarization that you see in American political society actually affects structures in the brain, biological traits that are sort of hardwired into people. The argument is something like there are like packages of attitudes that undergird the different poles of American politics. So summarizing here, not being entirely fair, but like conservatives have an attitude towards sort of absolutism and certainty, dogmatism, hierarchy on this view, while liberals gravitate toward openness, tolerance, egalitarianism. And I have to say, as someone who doesn't identify as conservative, that I read that and I think that's massively biased. I mean, I'm conservative. Oh yeah, I'm part of the absolutist, dogmatist, hierarchical tradition, while liberals are open, tolerant, and egalitarian. At the philosophical level, it naturalizes what we know are historical traditions. If genopolitics were true, then we should expect to find the same poles within all human societies. it also has to reduce varieties of conservatism and liberalism that scramble the attitudes. I mean, we've all known liberals who are dogmatic and absolutist at personal life, and we've all known conservatives who are open and tolerant. Even if we feel like these anomalies are vanishingly small now, the notion that you're sort of like bootstrapped into those attitudes is, I think, damaging, that there are these psychological tribes. It also can't make sense of political conversions. I'm someone who's had a lot of different political views over the course of my life, and it can't make sense out of why people would transition in and out of different political traditions, let alone creatively mix and match them. But I think that this is one of these looping effects where what's more interesting to me is, why did people want to read books like in 2012, like The Republican Brain by Chris Mooney, which was just a sort of journalistic popularization of genopolitics, or Thomas Edsel's columns in the New York Times about genopolitics? Why did people want to read? Why was there an audience that was hungry to hear that it's impossible to rationally persuade the other side by genopolitics, even says, you know, you don't want to mate with the other side? And so what was it about our politics of despair, our unreal realism, that viewed each other as unchangeable, hardwired, robotic, that we couldn't dialogue our way to any kind of understanding with one another, let alone make progress or persuade someone of something else? And so I find it interesting, as part of this map of the present that the book is kind of engaged in doing, where genopolitics is participating in the thing it claims to be describing. It's reinforcing, I won't say it's creating because I don't think so in this case, but it's reinforcing the existent polarization that's already happened, and it's painting it in the authority of science. It's a science that you dislike Republicans. It's a science that you dislike Democrats.
Yeah, and it's that's an interesting point about how the you know, taking the polarization as the jumping off point here, that how each side would be motivated to see the other as sort of, well, they're hopeless. And so a sort of natural disposition to being inclined in that direction might make sense of it. Of course, I suppose in one way, and I think this is a point Jonathan Haidt has made, who's sort of has a kind of relationship to this tradition, is, you know, that actually might be more beneficial to in a polarized world, and might reduce conflict if each side sees the other as sort of necessarily, you know, if we see, you know, well, conservatives, that's just how they are, so I can give them a pass, in contrast to seeing them as like open to transformation, moral transformation through persuasion, and the fact that they aren't means that they're bad people or something like that. Anyway, it seems like that's at least a point that Haidt has made, that, you know, there might be something beneficial to this, and sort of reducing the temperature of political conflict. I don't know what you think about that.
My problem with it is it's not true. At that point, it would be just a noble myth, and if it worked that way, and I have very grave doubts that it in fact works that way, and it might work that way in some people's cases, it might help them approach each other in that sense, though I think it's much more likely to be a symptom of political despair at our realism, you know, about the world. I also could see it pointing in very ugly directions in terms of eugenics and whatnot. If you think these are bad positions and they're just built and hardwired into people, you know, I don't see why someone couldn't just march off in another direction with that. But regardless of where people take it or not, I mean, just as someone, you know, trained in philosophy, it's wrong, you know. In fact, you know, there are varieties of conservatism and liberalism. I think of the French Revolution that look very different, right, than the attitudes that are being attributed to them by genopolitics. Similarly, there are forms of conservatism, think of someone like Michael Oakeshott, that are very different. How do I make sense of William Wordsworth, a poet I quite like, who went from French revolutionary radical, you know, he's got his famous poem about the enthusiasm for the revolution, to a very reactionary sort of state and church Brit. And which led Lord Byron to start calling him Turdsworth, is my understanding. But you know, how do you make sense of these conversions, and how do you make sense of the historical emergence? I mean, all the careful work that's been done in the history of political thought, people like the Cambridge School, et cetera, the genopolitics paradigm can't sustain historicity. So at that point, for me, it would just be, we'd be discussing like noble myths that I would actually sort of think of as ignoble myths, but I don't think that a historical biological account of their origins can sustain the historicity of an examination of those traditions.
Yeah, so the other social scientific tradition you critique, or one of the other ones you do in this chapter, is the well-known phenomenon of nudging, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with Sunstein and Thaler's nudging, but it fits perfectly in with what you're talking about, which is the technocratic side of the sort of social scientific view of the world, coupled with a conception of human beings as somewhat machines that sort of need to be nudged in the right direction. And think of a little like toy of my children who just, you know, need to be nudged in the right direction in order to go. Anyway, so it seems to me that that fits in with your theory. I mean, I wanted to just say, I mean, you feel free to say, you know, expand on your critique of nudging, but you know, I want it just as a way to sort of, I guess, put up a semi-defense in its favor. I take it part of the point of Sunstein and Thaler is that we're being nudged in all sorts of directions anyway, always by lots of different influences. So why shouldn't we engage in some kind of nudging for our general benefit?
Yeah, well, so I think most people are familiar with Thaler and Sunstein, but for the few who aren't, they emerge out of sort of the turn in behavioral economics that actually rejects the rational choice theory that I was talking about earlier, and is largely based on psychological research about our biases. So one example that really stands out in my mind from their book is the tendency toward conformism as a shortcut to making choices. So tendency to sort of bunching or herding when making a choice. Behavioral psychologists have argued that human beings have a strong bias toward doing what others are doing as a shortcut to thinking that's a good choice. It's kind of reminds me of the joke my uncle used to tell, that there's a line, let's go stand in it. You know, like there's a line there, so we should probably stand in it. What appears on your grid in Nudge, if you're a hermeneuticist like me and you start, you might say, okay, let's bracket the issue of whether or not people have cognitive biases of these kinds. Again, that argument about philosophy of action in a different moment. And by the way, I think that dialectically something is going to have to be conceded to those findings. Will as much be conceded as Thaler and Sunstein believe? No, probably not, if you're a hermeneuticist like myself, because of human beings' interpretive capacities. But what's interesting from the hermeneutic side, and what I make quite a fuss about in the section on that, is the whole, I think, uncritically constructed notion of democracy as headed by choice architects, they call them, that do the nudging. In other words, so Thaler and Sunstein are saying there's this thing called automatic mind cognitively, where we live out our biases and we make decisions that serve us well a lot of the time, but then every once in a while it's spectacularly bad to bunch and to herd, to just stand in the line because the line is there. But what they offer in its stead is that choice architects, a sort of managerialized democracy, exit automatic mind. So there's a group, there's an elite that can overcome its own cognitive biases, at least temporarily, to make public policy. And so their vision of democracy is extremely thin for someone like me who's a participatory and deliberative Democrat. Every 4 years, they're libertarian, as they call it, democracy. I vote on like the policy ends or outcomes. But then my, I'll say parenthetically, Ivy League betters, choice architects, make all these decisions about what my community and political life actually looks like to nudge me in the direction of those electoral choices. So my choice, my question, if you see these as meanings, as hermeneuticists, as within political life, it's not an accident that Sunstein was within the Obama administration. It does read like an apologia for sort of rule by educational betters who have the luxury in an increasingly unequal America to exit the automatic mind. My question, Rudy Nudge, is why don't we all just get a lot more leisure in education so we can all exit our automatic minds and make decisions together? But they just race right toward, oh, well, there's going to be these choice architects. And there's this kind of warmth of narrative voice in sort of suppressed warmth of narrative voice in their book, where there's a little bit of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, play on words intended with the reader. Like, you and I are going to be the choice architects, by the way, and the rest of America that's just busy trying to make a living and barely being able to make it to the ballot box will have all kinds of things decided for them. And so I say in the book that this is a Neoplatonic view. This is the bad Platonism. I find some stuff in Plato really interesting and helpful, but that you've got a kind of epistemic or cognitive elite that exits automatic mind and the lower brain and makes a lot of the decisions of political life for us. And so there's a lot more than simply the findings of behavioral bias. There's a whole constellation of meanings that replace deliberative, bottom-up democracy and egalitarianism with a highly top-down form of democracy that arguably gave us our current moment partly, or played a role in the populist backlash that says, I'm tired of being told, you know, what my policy looks like by people who, you know, I see as, you know, nefarious elites or something like this.
Right. That's exactly what I was just thinking, that actually both of these phenomena that you were talking about, turning us into homo economicus and turning us into homo machina, sort of have both in their ways led to, contributed to the populist backlash. Homo economicus because clearly the populists were not beneficiaries of the economic developments, and homo machina because they were themselves the object of the sort of manipulations of technocratic elites. So, which sort of, insults our dignity in certain deep ways, which is important to the populist movement.
At the very least, if I can just go really quick, at the very least, it replaces one notion of democracy with another. And it does go under the guise of just sort of a social scientific theory. I mean, I'm being a little harsh because they say it's a libertarian, et cetera, form of democracy. But social scientific authority is undergirding a managerialized democracy over and against participatory forms. And maybe participatory forms are just bad because you get the unwashed masses making bad, biased decisions. But I don't think that there's something like just a neutral social theory being offered by Nudge.
Yeah, so the last part of the book is about social science and law enforcement. And wow, what a great timing for the book. Very prescient given the developments this summer and the many protest movements. The book really speaks to our time, especially your section about police violence and how social science and the double H effect that resulted from it sort of helped contribute to some of the phenomena that we see. Do you want to just walk us through the double H effect here in how sort of the social science of the late 20th century helped sort of contribute to a scientization of law enforcement and the effect that it had, especially on the African-American community?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for the question, because this actually is very close to my heart for very personal reasons, the whole movement around Black Lives Matter and whatnot. But right, so in a way, I think of modern racism as a massive double H effect. And in the opener of the book, I talk about how Carl Linnaeus, the famous inventor of the binomial system of classification in biology, is also very implicated in the foundations of race as a concept, as a reductive concept, as a natural type, that within the human species, there are subspecies. And then he read into those subspecies all kinds of cultural and historical features that were white supremacist and racist. So there's a deeper backstory here where I think of race itself. Now, are there other sources of racism? Absolutely. There's theological, political, cultural, other forms. But I think the modern discourse on race in part comes out of an inappropriate inflation of scientific authority, which is why people like, you find people who are great figures of the Enlightenment involved in it, like Immanuel Kant and other figures such as that, involved in racialist theories and discourse. I think as you get closer to our own time, the discourses are much subtler and trickier. And part of what I try to argue in chapter five briefly is that you get what sociologists call colorblind concepts, that they do racialized work, but they're not racially marked. There's forms of criminology that emerge with the law and order movement. I'm thinking here, James Q. Wilson, Charles Murray, George Kelling, people who came up with get tough theories on crime that are supposedly, on their own terms, justified by social scientific theory. So, for instance, all too briefly, something like broken windows theory, which was a massively popular article a lot of people know about, of course, published in The Atlantic in the 80s by James Q. Wilson and I think it was George Kelling. And their argument was that people calculate on a kind of crime market. You need to crack down on small disorder like broken windows, because you don't crack down on that, then there's a strong correlation with assaults and homicide and so on. So part of the policing that we see, that zero tolerance, is connected to the discourse, social scientific discourse, around you need to crack down on small disorder. This the very sad strangulation of Eric Garner, captured on film for selling Lucy cigarettes. Why would you use a chokehold on someone selling Lucy cigarettes? Well, New York had been, New York police had been socialized into broken windows theory policing for the better part of a generation. Just real briefly tick off a couple of the other theories in the chapter. Incapacitation, right? The notion that you need to incapacitate, police need to incapacitate people, the militarization of police around things like SWAT team, the popular discourse in the 90s of predators and super predators that you heard not only on the right, but on the left as well, from people like Bill Clinton, all the way to Ronald Reagan. What was going on here? Well, this same clique of criminologists, political scientists, and social scientists had argued that you have statistical inputs into human beings, statistical behavioral inputs, that supposedly, although they don't determine criminality, raise the probability of criminality. And when you have enough of these inputs in place, then you've got this kind of propensity to crime that's so strong that you can't do anything about it. Wilson says, like, there's nothing you can, it's not straight determinism, it's a kind of statistical, it's almost not worth it to do anything. You can throw all the educational money you want at it. So there's an underlying critique here of social democracy in the New Deal. All policy, you know, just pales when you're dealing with a behavioral person who has so many inputs that make them predisposed to crime. The best you can do is incapacitate them. You need to take them out. You need to hunt them like they're predators. And this tracks, or at least I argue in the book, very close with race without ever being outwardly about race. The statistical inputs that people like Charles Murray and James Q. Wilson argued made people almost hopelessly criminal tracked very closely with different factors of race in America. And finally, then there's openly racial things like enacting racial profiles. I think Stuart Hall's been really important for thinking on this question, and reading bodies when we're reading bodies biologically, thinking we're doing culture, but in fact, or thinking we're doing biology when in fact we're doing culture. So there's a lot in the chapter. I probably should stop there because I get too excited about this and say too much.
Yeah, no, it's all very compelling in part because it's this summer has been great for sort of reviewing this history about the development of these policing strategies, and certainly the disproportionate effect that it's had on the African American community and so forth. And it's very helpful to hear the way in which, from your book, that the social science has a strong effect on that. I mean, in a certain way, it's very sad to hear it, because, I mean, again, if you think of this in terms of, you know, in the 1960s, when you see a decline in the relations among community, communal bonds begin to break down, and what is hastened to fill the gap and to reestablish law and order is not a form, as you say, you know, sort of social democratic form of community, but it's this technocratic assertion of impersonal authority, which, you know, is unsurprising that this is not going to effectively work and is in fact going to create its own backlash, which it certainly has. And we're seeing the effect of that backlash. So, I mean, in some ways, this is a great third example in your book, because it reveals once again the backlash and the self-defeating character of the, you know, assertion of the scientific authority against human beings.
Yeah. Yes, I basically was shocked at what happened this summer. Shocked and not shocked, but that there is this backstory that I think very few people are aware of, that modern racism is deeply entangled in scientism, not in legitimate social science, not in legitimate natural science, but in double H effects, where people are taking on board the authority of sciences to enact forms of racial hierarchy.
I wanted to talk about what could be done here in the last few minutes moving forward, because in some ways your book is a sad book, and it takes us through these the bad effects of the social sciences on our public culture. I mean, two things come to mind in what's to be done. One is how you close the book, which is to call for a new humanism, which I'm going to get to it at the end. But the other is a kind of reformed way that we might think about the social sciences. And, you know, for example, I mean, I guess, put it in this way to you. How might we do social science differently, or package social science differently in these different domains? You don't have to do all three, but in the domain of economics, or in the domain of politics, or in the domain of law and order and policing, you know, how might we use the social sciences more effectively?
Yeah, and that's a great question. It's a huge question. And it's something I've written on greater length in the book with Mark, Interpretive Social Science. So if people want an extended defense of the alternative, I think, for instance, in economics, there needs to be a historicizing turn. And it might surprise listeners to hear at this point that I'm actually not, I don't have a dualistic rejection of rational choice theory. I just think that rational choice needs to be far narrower as a methodology in terms of what it's doing and accomplishing. It needs to be treated as a thought experiment. It's not descriptively true. It's not explanatory, and it's not predictive, which have been the major defenses of it. And that's a very, very weird theory at that point. If it's not descriptive of human agency, it's not predictive, and it's not explanatory. Well, what is it then? Do we just chuck it in the trash? No, actually, I don't think we should. I think that rational choice models have a very limited usage in cases where, for instance, there happens to be a fit through iterative cultural practices, which has to do with why rational choice appears the most plausible and meets with the biggest successes in economics. Because in our culture, we have iterative practices of rationally calculating over our money that have some loose fit sometimes with rational choice modeling, though behavioral economics has shown that even that is not quite right. But I also think that rational choice can be useful for as-if stories, what Colin Hay calls as-if stories, where, you know, what if everyone did act self-interest in this way? What would it do to the, you know, tragedy of the commons and those kinds of dilemmas? But once you see rational choice in that much narrower form, then economics needs to become cultural and historical again, closer to its roots. What we need to be doing is telling narratives that place economy back within society and culture, and are sensitive to the cultural factors that influence and impact economy. I actually think there are some signs of economists doing more of this. Thomas Piketty's Capital, which is, of course, massively popular, he places it within a big historical narrative. Is it a full-blown hermeneutic economics? No, I don't think so. But it's made a good move in my view, and insofar as it's modeling about capital accumulation and whatnot occurs within really a tremendous amount of historical literacy about what's happened in the last centuries. So I think that, just to take one of your examples, but it would be true across the social sciences, the social sciences need to come back into the fold of the humanities. And hermeneutics holds that the primary explanatory form, as I was saying earlier, is narrative, and the largest horizon of meanings within which practices and actions sit is historical. It's worlds. It's what Hegel thought so much about. We have different worlds we occupy and live within. And so all the social sciences need to be more humanistic in that sense, on my view. They need to be more sensitive to the work that humanity scholars have often done, which is the careful interpretation of meanings in relationship of part to whole, what's called the hermeneutic circle, history as a horizon on which stuff is happening. But I have the view, and I share this with Mark, that you don't actually chuck out things like mass survey research and so on. So I'm not in the quantitative qualitative debate. I actually don't think we need to get rid of all the quantitative methods at all. I think quantitative methods can be quite helpful. I just think they need to be situated and limited much more within a humanistic approach to the discipline.
That's great. And you've finished the book by saying we need a new humanism. And in fact, I think you put it in a way, a sadder way than that, which is, where is the new humanism? Let me say the last page of your book. Yeah. The key question remains, where are the new humanists? Maybe you could say a little bit about what you mean. What would a new humanists look like on your view? And do you, I mean, are there examples of, you know, exemplars who maybe flown under the radar, or why we can't see them?
Robert Bella is a really impressive figure within sociology for me, in this respect. Charles Taylor has been a massive influence, his narrative of secularism. More broadly to that question, politically speaking, I think the crisis of our democracy right now and the crisis of the humanities are interrelated in a way that hermeneutics makes apparent and humanism makes apparent, which is the ancient question, the ancient Roman question, you know, with roots in the Greeks, about what is the education worthy of and necessary condition for being a free person. Hermeneutics picks up on that question and yet changes it substantively, because part of what the suggestion is here is that we need a kind of hermeneutic literacy to be citizens and to self-rule. We need to be better at interpreting the meanings around us so that we can distinguish true from false claims, fake news from real news, the boundaries of science from, you know, the realm that is interpretive and storytelling and so on. And that hermeneutic literacy is a condition for self-rule. And so I am quite sympathetic to people like William Morris, who thinks that a society that was remade generously and lavishly in terms of access to the humanities would be a radically different society than the one we currently have. And in my utopian vision, it would be a more democratic society. And so I think part of where the new humanists are has to do with the crisis of the liberal arts and the decline of what I would call hermeneutic literacy, or this kind of ability to read texts and read text analogs, which is society, people's actions, and so on.
Jason, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciated you joining me today on the Political Theory Review.
It's an honor to be here. I've enjoyed the show for a long time.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.